Okay.
So now we are going to get to the epsilon definition of limit. That's what we're working up towards today. So that's in section 3.1. So we talked about a limit definition last time, right? This is from chapter 1. Right, it was a monotone sequence, right? It means the sequence is it's either increasing or it's decreasing, right? So either each term is greater than or equal to the previous term, or each term is lesser than or equal to the previous term. And so this definition said, and when you write this limit, this means that for every decimal place, eventually, an here's one way I like to put it. I like to say an stops, disagreeing with L at that decimal place, right? If you want to make it really strong, you could say forever stops, make it clear. I'd give better emphasis. Okay? So you wait and wait, eventually the integer part is correct and then it's never wrong again. You have to wait maybe longer, and then the first decimal place is correct. And it stays correct. After some further waiting, the second decimal place is correct, and then it stays correct. Maybe you have to wait even longer, but eventually the third decimal place is correct, and it stays correct. Eventually the fourth decimal place will become correct and stay correct. Now, the problem with the definition is you have to worry about, how are you representing L, right? Because of the problem of 0.999999 equals 1, right? Now, what if your sequence is not monotone, right? What if it goes, instead of just going up and up and up, or going down, 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 it goes back and forth, up and down, up and down. I'll show you what I mean. So all the sequence,
that's going to converge, let's say, to 2.3. Okay, here's my sequence. 1.8, 2.5. And this sequence is not going to be monotone. Right? It's going to go up and down. Right? 2.3, 4, 2.3, 8, 2.2, 2.3006, 2.2957, 2.3007, 2.3009997, 2.2999992.3000008, and it keeps going. And okay, so we imagine some infinite sequence. I'm not going to say what all the infinitely many terms are, but it's supposed to converge to 2.3. Now the issue is there's two ways to represent 2.3. Right? It could be, you could write it in the 2.3 and then imagine, you know, zeros going on forever. You could also think of it as 2.2999999999 is going on. Same thing. So in this sequence so far, we want to say that every decimal place eventually gets correct. There's the integer part. Well, it looks like once, as soon as we get here, at least in the sequence so far, it appears that the whole number part, you know, the part of the left decimal point is 2, looks like it's good. It's fine. Then now we have an issue of, since there's these two representations, this sequence, it's never really settling down. The second decimal place keeps going back and forth. It's 2, then 3, 3, 2, 3, 2, 3, 3, 2, 2, 3. That decimal point never settles down. That digit never settles down. So what can we say? Well, we can say that at least eventually it limits itself to be 2 or 3, right? So that it agrees with this one or this one. Right? So it looks like starting here, you've got 2.2 and 2.3, so those are good. And then eventually, looks like starting here, we've got either 2.30 or 2.29, and it seems like beyond that point, unless something funny happens in the dot, dot, dots, we've got three decimal places correct. But the problem is I'm having to consider two decimal places. And it looks like starting here, we've got three decimal places that are good. Unless something goes wrong in the dot, dot, dots, everything is good for the first three decimal places starting here. But this doesn't feel very elegant to me. You have to worry about possibly two decimal representations if your number is irrational, that is a finite decimal. Right? It has some numbers, like 2.3, have two representations. You don't want to have to worry about this. And what's so special about decimal? I mean, I know we have 10 fingers, but this should just be something about the real line. 10 shouldn't be important here. It should just be a simple concept. So we tend to not think too much about decimals. It's better to abstract away the core idea. The core idea is that you're getting close to 2.3, right? What is that decimal place stuff telling you? Once you have the whole number part right, then you're at worst one off from this limit value. Once you have the second decimal place right, you're at most 0.1 away from the limit value. Once you have the second decimal place right, you're at most 0.01 away. Once you have the third decimal place right, you're at most 0.001 away from the true value. Okay. So that leads us to the chapter 3 definition, which is a more general definition, which makes this just a special case. Right? So instead of thinking about integers and so on, now we're just going to say, well, for any number, whether it's 1.1 or 0.01 or 0.001, or for that matter, 0.00007846, and whatever, for any distance, we eventually get the sequence that close to the limit value, and it stays that close to the limit value. So, for every, and the traditional letter for the distance is epsilon, and it's got to be a positive distance, right? So, eventually, okay, what are we going to say? So we're going to say AN, something like, forever stops disagreeing with L up to distance epsilon or something like that. So eventually, let's put it like this. If you wait long enough, you're within distance epsilon, strictly within distance epsilon. Okay? So eventually, if you wait long enough, if the n is big enough, this will become true and stay true. Right? So it could oscillate. It could be close then far for a while, but eventually it gets this close and it stays this close. Now, more formally, how does this look? It's going to be a chart. For every distance, okay, now we have to turn that eventually into something a little more symbolic, right? You wait long enough, okay? So let's give a symbol to how long we have to wait. Maybe we have to wait for the first billion terms to go by. I don't know. Yeah, but let's just give it a name. Let's call it capital N, and I'm going to put a little epsilon subscript. This is just some number, but I put a subscript there to emphasize that it depends on epsilon. And now
we want that inequality over there to be true and stay true, right? So in other words, starting here and forever after, so for all n greater than or equal to that, think of this as a wait time, right? So after you've waited long enough, now you will always have that inequality. So our picture is that we have our real number line, and you have, some dots, all kinds of crazy stuff could happen. Before that point, right? We promise nothing, right? About those. Right? Maybe here is L plus epsilon, and symmetrically here is L minus epsilon. Yeah. There can even be a point in the sequence that hits the limit exactly. But there could be lots of points, with that are outside of those bounds. Right? We promise nothing about the early points, but later. After all that, think of this as early garbage or whatever that's happened, then we get to the good stuff. Equal to L exactly. We're not saying anything about that. We're just saying, okay, it's somewhere in there. Now, there's some abbreviations the book likes to use to make this easier to understand. Instead of having to write something like this, the book will just say something like this. For n large, right? It's for n much bigger than 1, okay? So this is a lot easier to read and a lot easier to write down, but it's hiding some of the inherent complexity of the definition. I mean, how large does it have to be? Well, that depends on epsilon. Okay. And then this thing here, we'll also get abbreviated. Now, the way we abbreviate it is we use absolute value signs. Yes, right. So if you subtract L from both sides of this, or not both sides, but like subtract L from all three terms, right? Just take these three points on the number line and then slide these three points such that L is at 0. Okay? So subtract L from all three of them. And then you'll slide this down to negative epsilon, slide this down to an minus L, slide this down to positive epsilon. Okay, so we can
And if you remember absolute values, right? This is more compactly written this way. And then the book likes to write that in a more suggestive way. An is close to L. How close? Epsilon close. Less than epsilon away. So this is the book's notation. I have a squiggly equal sign, meaning they're approximate, but we put epsilon under the equal sign to indicate we're promising the discrepancy is smaller than epsilon. So this is the way we're going to think about limits, you know, going forward. It subsumes this stuff as a special case, because here, you know, with the decimal expansion stuff, you're really just saying eventually you're less than one away, eventually you're less than a tenth away, eventually you are less than a hundredth away, eventually you're less than a thousandth away. Questions or comments? So think back to Calculus 2, right? You talked about sequences and series in Calculus 2. If you took Calculus 2 here, you probably used the Stewart book, and all that sequence and series stuff is in Chapter 11, right? There's a lot of overlap between Calculus 2 and this course. The difference of this course is that the emphasis is more on proofs, more on why is this or that true. So, in order to really compute various things, we need to have rules for manipulating stuff of this form. If you have some particular sequence given by some particular algebraic formula, you need to be able to figure out how the algebra interacts with this kind of stuff. Okay. Now, we did some stuff last time with some estimates. So lots of estimates come up. So remember, if you have, say, positive numbers, right, then you can safely multiply inequalities. But remember, if you're estimating a fraction, things get flipped around. To make a fraction bigger, you make the numerator bigger and the denominator smaller. Thank you. So we have these kinds of estimates. And of course, we have the good old, for any two things.
Now, a lot of the headaches with negative numbers are avoided by working with absolute values. Multiplying an inequality or figuring out fraction inequalities, you really can get into trouble if there's some negative numbers lurking around. You have to start doing a lot of case-by-case analysis. Well, if this one's positive, then this happens. If this one's negative, then this happens. When possible, you want to avoid that. And so we have rules. So for example, we know this kind of rule already. Something's between a number and its opposite if and only if the absolute value is bounded above by that, right? So on the one hand, you can say stuff like negative A is less than B is less than negative A if and only if the absolute value of B is less than A. And you can do the reverse if you're careful. So what if I had... this is reversible, but what if the bounds were a little different? What if I had this, and I had the problem that maybe some of these numbers are negative, so I want to make it absolute values to avoid that problem. So there should be some control on B here from this. So here's the control we have. Okay. Absolute value of B is the distance from B to zero. Okay. So how far away from zero could B be? Well, it's somewhere between A and C. And you could draw pictures if you wanted to see the different cases. One case is, here's ABC, and say zero's over here. Another case, though, you have zero in there. Another case, you have zero in here. Think about it, there's actually four places zero could be. Okay. Not necessarily by absolute value of C in all cases. Like this case, you need absolute value of A to be sure that
you've got an upper bound for the distance.
And let's see, the fourth case.
That.
You can really see it in the fourth case. The absolute value of C would not be enough. Now, if you want to get picky, you could argue I left some cases out. Zero could have been exactly A. Zero could have been exactly, B. Zero could have been exactly C. The trick with that is, let's not worry about that so much. We can handle those cases if we just make this a weak inequality, make these less than or equal to's. So then we don't have to think too hard about what happens. Right? And so in all four of these cases, you get this. So if you have symmetric bounds here, right, yay. You can go back and forth. This is not quite reversible. You're actually, depending on what A and C are, you may be losing some information here. But sometimes this is all the information you need, and this is easier to work with than that. Triangle inequality. You should know that. And if you want to do a proof of it, it's going to look like one of these case analyses here. You can break it up into cases on what is less than what, and what is less than zero. You can work it all out. There's actually a lower bound you can put here that is sometimes also useful. What kind of lower bound could I put here? Anybody remember that? Or did you see something like that in chapter? You can discover it through experimentation, then you can turn that into proofs. So, for example, consider 7 and 3. Okay. And to sort of give you an idea of the different sign cases, right? Good. Negative 4 has absolute value 4. Negative 10 has absolute value 10. 10 has absolute value 10. So the other side is this. Sometimes that's handy. And there's actually another version of this. You can use this inequality to prove something else. What if we had a minus in there? Well, that's just the same as a plus negative b. And The absolute value of B is the same as the absolute value of negative B. Okay? So I could use this inequality in the form A plus negative B, which is the same as, you know, A minus B. So you can have this also true if there's just a minus sign right there. These kinds of things are very handy for doing epsilonics, as it's sometimes called. You have some algebraic expression inside the absolute value sign, and it's more complicated than this, and you have to work with it. So let's see an example here. So, for example, 2.6b, I believe. I see what I want. 3.1B. That's right. This is an old chestnut. See how to use these inequalities. Successive square roots of whole numbers tends to zero. We can prove it using our epsilon definition. So, given epsilon positive, we need to find n. Now, n depends on epsilon, but I'm not going to write a little epsilon subscript every time. Such that the nth term of our sequence is epsilon close to zero for all n at least capital N. How are we going to do that? Right. You can write some inequalities. Often you want to work backwards. And hopefully your steps will be reversible so you can make it into an honest proof. Okay. So let's write this down. So we want to be less than epsilon away from the zero. So if you wrote it like this, Well, the zeros aren't doing anything for us in this case, right?
Okay, so we can forget about the zero. We just need to say that the difference is small. Now what do I do? Well, this one, there's an algebraic trick to it, right? So, I rewrite it in the following funny way. You may have seen this before in one of your calculus classes. Maybe it came up in computing a limit like this, or in looking at the definition of the derivative of the square root of x. So I'm going to have the same thing inside the absolute value sign, just rewritten in this funny way. And then it's like a plus b times a minus b, right? Difference of squares. So far, every step has been reversible. All I've done is just rewritten the thing inside the absolute value sign the same way. Yeah. Let's see here. A little simplification here. We get n plus 1 minus n. Right? This squared minus that squared. Oh, okay. Okay, we've got reciprocal there. So you need another rule. Right? Let's add some other useful rules to our list here, right? I had some rules here about addition and subtraction. How about multiplication and division? Absolute values work great with those, right? I'm going to rewrite the left side. See, so this, all the steps are reversible. Okay. So the absolute value of 1 is just 1. So, maybe I can just keep them here for the moment. By the way, this one, you can flip this around. The A minus B is the opposite of B minus A. So these two absolute values here and here are the same, right? So several helpful forms. Now, here, what am I going to do?
Well, it's a take reciprocals. The key here is this left side is positive, right? And this is positive. So we really don't have to worry about flipping the order, negative signs messing us up. But remember, since the reciprocal does a flip.
Interesting. Okay, so let's write it up so it makes sense. All right.
Now, so far every step has been reversible. Now, I'm going to make an actual backwards step, okay? So, what I want to do is, I'm trying to make sure this is big enough. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to round it down and show that something rounded down is big enough. Okay. So if this is big enough, then that will also be big enough, right? Because this is even a little bit bigger. Okay. And you know what? At this point, I really need the absolute value signs. This is positive because n is a natural number, right? It's positive. So. So ultimately, I have to make some kind of simplification move to solve this. So the key here does I rounded this down and simplified. And now, let's see, basically you solve this for n. Remember, n is positive, so we don't have to worry about a negative number having the same square as some positive number. It's all positive numbers involved. So, okay, so just divide both sides by 2. I'm trying to skip too many steps here. Since these are positive numbers, we can go ahead and we can safely square both sides. So. Okay. So that's it. You can use say that, right? As long as you're bigger than this, you'll be your sequence. As long as n is bigger than 1/4 ε² your sequence will be sufficiently close to 0. And the terms in your sequence are there. And I try not to skip steps here. Now let me show you some more epsilonics, okay? So for example, what if I had this? I had two numbers that are, I have some guarantees about how close these numbers are, and I have another two numbers with some other guarantee about how close they are. Okay, I claim that from this, you can deduce that if you add, right,
the left sides, you add the right sides, then you've got this kind of a distance guarantee now. They're that close together. And the proof is, you know, just it's just the triangle inequality. Okay? There's some, the only moderate amount of cleverness is to rearrange this into A minus B plus C minus D. Then it's just, okay, triangle inequality. But this one is less than delta, and this one is less than epsilon. Similarly, if A is close to B and B is close to C, then A is close to C. How close? Well, we know it's at least delta plus epsilon close if A is delta close to B and B is delta close to C. Okay, so again, there's a moderate little algebraic trick here. You turn the A minus C into A minus B plus B minus C. Then you hit it with the triangle inequality. Then you use your hypotheses, delta closeness and epsilon closeness. So the distance from A to C is less than delta plus epsilon. Done. You can do some more advanced versions of this too. Let me show you, to take a picture. What if we had, instead of adding two proximity relations, we tried to multiply. Is A times C to B times D. Let me call that, I guess I'll use another Greek letter, rho. What's my estimate for rho? My estimate for rho is absolute value of A times epsilon. So value of D times delta. Motivation is geometric. Okay. So let's say that we have A here, and then B is a little bit bigger. difference delta. And then here's C, say D is a little bit bigger. Here's the difference epsilon. Okay. In here, I have A times C. The bigger rectangle is B times D. What's the difference between the smaller rectangle and the bigger rectangle? Well, you have two things, right? You have A times epsilon, and you have D times delta. Now, there's some concern here. First of all, technically delta is an upper bound for A minus B, right? And epsilon is an upper bound for D minus C, so that's not quite right. So this is a kind of, you know, idea. But let's make it more precise. This suggests, let's try to do it the right way. I'm gonna have to worry on what if there's some negative stuff in there. Okay, let's write it correct order here. BD, the bigger rectangle. So I just write it this way. So it looks like we're expecting A times looks like epsilon D minus C. Okay. And then we're expecting a D times a B minus A. Well, let's see. Is this true even when some of the numbers are negative? Let's just use the distributive law. AD minus AC plus DB minus DA. Aha! AD and DA cancel. And so I can rewrite it. That's DB. That's the same as BD. Algebraically, it works out even if there's some negative numbers. So that's how I came up with that. So let's see if we can do all the epsilonics here. We're going to use the absolute values to try and make this a proof. Okay. So here's our proof using that little bit of algebra there. All right. So we want to show that AC minus BD is less than this distance that I call rho. Okay. So let's see if we can. Okay, so we're just going to write it. Well, first of all, you know, the distance from AC to BD is the same as the distance from BD to AC. Right? So it doesn't matter that I had the order different there. We're doing absolute values. Okay, now, triangle inequality. Now, we use multiplication right property, that sometimes called the homogeneity property of the absolute value. Something we would like to say we know that this is going to be smaller than epsilon. That's one of the hypotheses. We know this is going to be smaller than delta. So we want to conclude, okay, it's less than absolute value of A times epsilon plus D times delta. Now, there is, that's almost right. There's one annoying little case where this would not quite be a correct proof. Mm-hmm. How could things go wrong? The only way things could go wrong, what if A and D were both zero? That's the way things could go wrong here. That's the only way things could go wrong. See, if this was zero, then this product would be zero. And if this was zero, this product would be zero. And then you'd be saying that a distance is strictly less than zero. Okay. No, you can't be strictly less than zero. So the issue is that if you multiply by zero, you could turn a strict inequality into a weak inequality. So that's the only issue here. So it turns out that this actually isn't quite true. There's one. There's just this annoying little case. Right. So to actually make it a valid proof, you would have to add a hypothesis to fix it. Right. So, okay. So we can do that. One way to do it is you just sneak it in like this, zero to that. Right. That's one solution to the problem. Right. Just put the hypothesis in. Then you're fine. But so if we assume they're not, now we've got a valid proof. There's a slightly cleaner way to deal with it, which is to say it would have just been more natural, instead of working with the strict, strictly closer than delta, strictly closer than epsilon implies strictly closer to rho, if we would have just used weak inequalities all along, then we wouldn't have gotten into that annoying corner case we have to worry about this, right? So So we could just write another version, which is if A minus B is less than, and now we allow equal to, and C minus D is less than or equal to epsilon, then we could conclude that AC minus BD is less than or equal to that quantity rho. Then we didn't have any of that stuff. The only difference with that proof is that you'd have a less than or equal to right there. So, yeah, sometimes little annoyances like that could happen. You wanted a strictly less than, but you only got a less than or equal to. But let me show you that that's really not the end of the world for most of our applications. A lot of times we're trying to prove something of the form, for every epsilon, such and such is strictly less than epsilon. Right? Such and such is eventually strictly less than epsilon. Just getting less than or equal to epsilon is good enough. Okay, so let's suppose we prove that for all epsilon, there exists, say, I'll use a different letter this time. There exists m epsilon such that for all n at least that big, we have something smaller than epsilon, okay? Could be a n minus l, like in the limit definition, could be something else, okay? So we get something like that. Except we don't get quite the strict. We only get the less than or equal to. We actually can get the strict version for free now. Okay? So for each epsilon, here's what you do. And by the way, this should be epsilon positive, right? Here's what you do. Just pick a number that's still positive, but a little bit smaller than epsilon, say. Something between 0 and epsilon. So let n epsilon be, say, half of epsilon, which is still going to be positive, right? Then, for all n, at least n sub epsilon, this thing that you were trying to prove was small, well, what have you got? Since you're using this epsilon over 2 wait time, what do you have? You're going to have less than or equal to epsilon over 2, but that's strictly less than epsilon. So if you do some proof and you only get a less than or equal to epsilon in the end, usually you're trying to prove it for all epsilon positive. So you can do this little trick here. You know, in fact, sometimes people won't even bother to mention this little trick at the end. You know, they'll just prove this and then they'll know, okay, if I can get less than or equal to epsilon for all epsilon, then I can get strictly less than epsilon because I can just replace my wait time, say, for epsilon that was only giving me weak inequality with the weak inequality wait time for epsilon over 2 to get it strict. So you can have some corner cases like this when you're trying to get a strict inequality. And sometimes the cleanest approach is just let it be a weak inequality.
And because of a phenomenon like this, it probably won't matter that, yeah, you only got a weak inequality. You can recover the kind of strict inequality you need.
Okay. All right. Any questions or comments? All right. Good luck with the homework. Get in touch with me if you'd like to talk about your first draft or you want a hint.